From Rochester, New York, this is Mad Dog Movies.
Woohoo!
Episode 9. Well, welcome to the show. This is Mike Boas. I'm an animator, and I'm very tired today.
And this is John Vincent. I am also tired, and I am a filmmaker.
Wow, in that order.
Yes, it's the way it works out.
All right. So how's your week? How's your weekend?
Well, good. I got some jobs coming in, which is always a good thing. Looks like I'll be doing some stuff for the Discovery Channel.
Oh, wow. Is that something you could talk about?
I guess. I mean, it's a documentary they're shooting in Rochester about our good buddy Arthur Shawcross, the serial killer.
Local serial killer.
Yeah, so I have to do some reenactments. So I haven't gotten the complete details, but that'll be in August, so that's good.
Would you be doing scouting for that? No,
I'll be probably making up bodies to look like, some makeup effects stuff and some probably period propping from the mid-80s.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
Interesting. Yeah, when you said that to me earlier, I was thinking you were doing something production-oriented or location scouting.
Yeah, no, it's our art department stuff and makeup effects stuff. I don't know to what extent yet, but we'll find out soon enough.
Well, that could lead into one thing we wanted to talk about today, which was what are the different sort of descriptions of some of these jobs that, in my head, I don't quite know the difference between, say, art direction and production design. Or set dressing.
I think it's confusing to people who look at the credits and don't know the film. Even some people in the film business, it gets a little muddled to what people do.
And sometimes things get listed incorrectly in credits or in IMDb, for instance.
Yeah. Like, for instance, the movie I'm working on right now, Alexander Payne, executive producing this movie, Bob Magnanelli is the writer and director. We did After Image. In that film, I am the production designer.
Right.
And a co-producer. And the film we did several years ago called After Image, although I was miscredited, I was an art director and I was the special effects supervisor.
I was going to say, when it came time, I mean, the people you were working with knew what your job was, but whoever was
you got to remember the when we did After Image, the people that produced the film, they haven't really produced anything really big before. One of John Cook had made some smaller feature films, and Chris Nakis hadn't produced a feature yet, and that was his first feature.
Sure.
So they didn't know exactly what specific credits were what. I mean, it wasn't too bad. I mean, I got credited for something that I wasn't doing, and I didn't get credited for something that I did do. It wasn't a big deal, because instead of calling me a special effects supervisor, I was a special effects coordinator.
Yeah.
Now, you might not think that's a big difference, and in some instances, it's not. But I was in charge of all the effects on the movie in terms of all the physical effects, any special props that had to be made, explosions, glass breaking. And then on the other end, I was also working in the art department as an art director and a set builder. I would design and build the sets that had to be designed and built. So I got credited as a set dresser. And I really didn't do any set dressing. And what I really did was art direction.
So what's the difference?
The difference is an art director. It starts off at the top, with a production designer.
The bigger the production, the more people.
Well, it depends. I think it's more visually intricate the movie is, the bigger a chance that you're going to have a production designer. A production designer literally designs everything you see in the film. And generally, it's for a specific reason. The director, the writer-director, or just the director has a specific vision. Mm-hmm. For the movie, and it's from start to finish. And the production designer
creates shapes and colors.
It everything gets coordinated. For instance, in a script, when you read a script, every word, every part of that script has to go someplace. It has to lead, leads to B, B leads to C, and eventually you get to the end of the story. So there's nothing in a script, in the written word, that it's not supposed to be. That's irrelevant to the plot. Everything's supposed to drive the plot.
Okay.
So in a visual sense, the production designer does the same thing, but with what you see. Mm-hmm. You read a screenplay and it'll say, you know, interior location, house. Mm-hmm. And the difference between someone who may be an art director and goes and finds an interesting house, it might look good on film. A production designer designs the house so that it fits into the story, and the actual visuals are a progression of the story and an intricate part of a story.
So if I was thinking of a really visual movie like Blade Runner.
Yes.
Obviously, they've got both production designers and art directors on it, probably.
Right. There's one production designer.
Okay.
But what basically happens is the production designer will sit down and come up with the director generally, mm-hmm. with the overall look of the film. Where is the film going? Now, that is the sets.
Yeah.
That is the wardrobe.
Right.
That is makeup. That is visual effects. Mm-hmm. Everything that you see goes through the production designer, because it really is a design of the production. So it's just not building sets. Mm-hmm. It really is, you literally are designing the film mm-hmm. from start to finish. Now, below the production designers, you have art directors.
Right.
Now, those are the people that go and execute what the production designer comes up with. And it's very collaborative as well, because the art directors have a lot of, you know, the director or the production designer will say, listen, guys, we really need this room to convey the fact that this dead person, let's say, or he's a ghost,
okay,
that he is part of this house.
Okay.
So we just don't make the house scary. We would infuse the house with personality of the person. So, and it might not be that obvious to the viewer unless you really broke it down and analyzed it. But that's what it entails. And then the art directors, you know, will come up with some ideas on how to do that. And the production designers will say yes and say no and then kind of create the whole flow. And then underneath the art directors, you have
set builders,
set builders, you have set dressers.
Okay.
You have all kinds. There's props.
Yeah.
And all kinds of any number of things underneath that. And go on forever.
In the productions I've worked on with you, what I've noticed is, you know, very specific tasks for specific people. And everyone's – so that's the most important thing that they have to deal with.
Yeah. If you're dealing on a decent-sized project, like we did a short of Mind Rip.
Yeah.
It was like a scene from the film. And we were lucky because I had a lot of people that I had worked with and everybody volunteered. So I was lucky to have like 30 people work on that.
That was really impressive.
You know, that short. And we spent two nights, late nights at a cemetery here in Rochester, mm-hmm. in Pittsford, actually the Pittsford Cemetery.
But the electric people didn't really touch the camera people stuff and vice versa.
No. And that's the way it usually works. Unless you're working on a really tiny, tiny independent and people wear a lot of hats. But generally speaking, you know, and like, yeah, you know, you have grip and electric, you know, the grips set the lights up, the electrics run the power and run the cables. And,
sure.
And you have swing gangs, which go back and forth. A lot of people don't know what these mean. And of course, there's a gaffer who is in charge of the lighting. You know, in terms of the camera department, you start off with the director of photography.
Yep.
So he's the one designing the look, the light, the lighting of what the production designer builds and designs. A lot of the times, the director of photography and the production designer work hand in hand with it, because he's going to be designing the look in terms of the lighting, the camera movements, the lenses, you know, because it gets very, very deep. You build a set, you know, it's going to look different with a 50 millimeter lens as it does, you know, different than a 300 millimeter lens. Right. And it's going to look like a different set. So you work with the director of photography for that, with that, and he comes in with all his ideas. And below the director of photography, you have the camera assistants, but on the other end of that, you have with the gaffer. And a lot of times the gaffer can be someone who actually designs the lighting, and they can be, you know, or they can just be someone who executes what the director of photography wants.
Right.
The director of photography, also called a cinematographer.
I was just going to ask you.
Same one and the same.
Aren't there some that only like to refer to as?
That's a whole other world, you know, that I want to get into. So the director of photography will tell, I forgot ASC. Where. I forgot what I was.
Oh, I'm sorry. So sometimes you have the gaffer setting up the
The director of photography will just say, listen, I need, you know, a couple of PARs, I need some HMIs, and then the gaffer has his crew, and the gaffer's crew are the grip and the electric. Mm-hmm. So he's basically in charge of the lighting, and that can mean creative charge of the lighting, or it could be just being in charge of the lighting, okay, depending on the production.
So let's get back to, you know, you're acting as production designer and co-producer on
The Maze. Film. Yeah.
Yeah. Is it The Maze now?
The name has been changed to The Maze, okay, as opposed to Man in the Maze.
Sure.
Shortened. Yeah.
So on a day-to-day basis, are you drawing pictures? Are you coming up with lists of what sort of props and things you'd need?
Or? Yeah. Basically, I would go through the script,
yeah,
and then I would do an initial jot down initially what I think the budget's going to be, mm-hmm, for the production, and it's a very general number.
Yeah, it gets more specific the more.
Then if that number's too big, and they say, John, that's too much, then it comes back. Then I know how I have to design things, mm-hmm, in terms of the budget. If there was an unlimited budget, then of course the scale of the designing would be much different.
Sure.
So I look at the script and I sit down with the director. I sat down with the director, Bob Meganelli, last fall, and I created storyboards. Mm-hmm. So I sat down and drew out the more visually complicated scenes in the film. It's very effects oriented,
right,
in terms of hallucinations and visions and things like that go on in the
fantasy
script.
Dream,
well, sort of, yeah, spiritual, okay, a lot of spiritual things going on. Floating in space and, you know, that kind of a thing. So I would, you know, come up with a lot of ideas and say, you know, read Bob Meganelli's words and try to visually interpret those and say, Bob, is this what you were thinking? And he'll say, yes, that's great. Or, well, more this, you know, and then I would sit down and actually draw out every panel of every shot.
When you're drawing these out, are you thinking, how are we going to do it? Or does that come later?
Well, you know,
practically.
Well, I have a visual effects background,
right,
so that comes in handy, in the sense I know how things are done, and I know how much things cost, and I know the complexity of shooting those scenes. So I, within that budget frame, I have to really be conscious, mm-hmm, of what is practical that we're going to be able to pull off, and,
yeah,
you know, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, like I said earlier, you could go crazy if there's an unlimited budget. But we're working on a movie that's between 10 and 15 million, which isn't a whole lot.
Right.
I mean, it's enough, but it's not really a lot of money, especially for the type of movie that we're doing.
So are there times where you're like, okay, we could do it this way, but that means we can't do three other things, or we could do it this way, and do you come up with
I think more I try to accomplish what Bob's trying to do. Mm-hmm. Visually, so I try to keep it. I take what he wants and what the real essence of what he's trying to convey in these scenes, and then I create them visually on the paper within the budgetary constraints that we have. Mm-hmm. And it seems to work out pretty good. And I sometimes find if you do have budgetary constraints,
yeah,
it ends up sometimes being more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure why, but it really, you know, if you really have this huge budget, sometimes it becomes overwhelming and really pull you out of the story. So if you have a lower budget, you really have to concentrate on what's important,
right,
to tell the story.
There's plenty of real world movie examples of that, you know, movies that had too big a budget and they weren't as successful.
Yeah, they're crazy. I mean, and that's one reason. I mean, when we did After Image and Kathy Sweeney, or she likes to be called Cat Sweeney.
Right.
I was a production designer on that film, and she did a hell of a job. We had no money. We really had no money. Me and my assistant, Michael, and some other people were working for her.
You had John Mellencamp.
Oh, God.
Oh, I won't get into that.
Oh, Mellencamp. That's a whole other.
Kat had, you know,
catastrophe.
Her work cut out for her.
She did. And so basically, we, even though she was in charge and everything got okay through her, and all that stuff, and she would say, John, we're going to need this. It was like, okay, John, go build a set. And so I designed the set and I built it,
yeah,
with her approval, you know, of course. So, But with that movie was really done for $1.4 million.
Yeah.
And it looks like it was made for closer to $10 million.
I've seen it. I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, the film doesn't work as a whole because John Mellencamp was an idiot.
Well, there's some story problems.
Well, here's maybe, the thing. Yeah. The story problems exist in that movie. 95% of the reason is because Mellencamp could not pull off the character and the dialogue.
And so edit around
the exposition end up lying on the editing room floor because he couldn't deliver it, and it was really bad the way he was portraying this character.
You might never ever work with him again now.
A Mellencamp? You know what happened the first day of the set?
With a camera?
No, we were down shooting in the High Falls in Rochester the very first day, and his family was there, his beautiful wife and his two lovely children. And the first day, we set up a dolly track. The grips will set up dolly track, and these are pieces of wood that they use to level it off. They're like 8 inches, 2x4s cut up into 8 inches and wedges and stuff. Mm-hmm. Well, the first day, his son comes up and kicks the piece of wood, hits me right in his shin. It's like, ow! Yeah. And the kid turns around, walks away. I said, from that point, I go, oh boy, this is going to be a real thrill and a half.
Wow.
So that started off a whole thing. But Bob really had to wrestle with him the whole movie. And we're going off on another tangent, but we're just
can I tell you my tangent story?
Sure, go ahead.
Unless you're off on your...
No, go ahead. Okay. Go ahead.
When I watched the movie, I'm watching it on DVD, and it was... a lot of noise in the house at the time, so I hit the subtitles. So I'm watching it with the subtitles on. Now, the subtitles are for English for the hearing impaired.
Right.
So when the sign language character comes on...
The actress Tara Lane.
Okay, she's deaf in the movie.
She's deaf in real life, yeah.
Okay. She's doing sign language, and of course, there's no subtitles during the sign language.
Oh.
So I'm watching the movie going, this is really interesting. I don't know what she's saying, but I'm getting it through.
Right. And that was one of the it's funny you should say that.
But later on, I turn off the subtitles and I find out that her sign language is supposed to be subtitled and I wasn't getting it earlier on.
Right. See, I saw the film probably about 4 or 5 times in a number of different screenings. One of them had all the subtitles.
Yeah.
And they had the subtitles for the sign language. Mm-hmm. And then I saw it. They had one. They had it without the subtitles for the sign language.
Yeah,
and it vastly improved the movie for me. It really did.
Yeah,
and I don't know why they left in the subtitles because it was so much better.
It's more compelling when you're trying to figure out what the person's trying to say.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And then Mellencamp, when he's signing, he's talking out his sign, so you're getting half the conversation verbally anyway.
Right. Yeah.
So I don't know. It's kind of like,
it was a fun movie to work on. I mean, I did all kinds of things. I mean, Mike Della Rosa, who has Multivision Effects, he did the makeup effects for the film, and so we had Louise Fletcher was also in the film.
Right.
When the movie, she dies. I'm sorry. I hope I'm not giving anything away, but she dies,
her character is sick throughout the movie. Right?
She's not. Yeah, and so. She dies, and then they have her cremated. So we had to create this whole crematorium situation. And Mike and his partner created a copy of a
pretend furnace of some sort.
I built a furnace. Michael Kelnitz and I, my assistant on the movie, we built a fake furnace, and then they rolled in the silicone dummy of Louise Fletcher.
Oh, Della Rosa did the dummy. Okay,
Della Rosa did the dummy, and he did the makeup and the victims and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And pushed it in and blasted these flames, and the camera was about 15. So we faked it, and it was great. I mean, we were just winging the whole movie.
Did the dummy actually burn, or did you?
It got a little hot, yeah. But the flames were above it, right. You know. So and the flames are between the object you're shooting and the camera. Yep. It's hard to distinguish what's in the flames and what's not. Mm-hmm. So that was a lot of fun. So we did a lot of fun things. I made a lot of rain.
You had someone go through a window.
We rigged up a set where. The actor Michael Zellnicker, who was in Naked Lunch, if anybody is familiar with a famous Canadian actor, and he goes flying out of a window. So we had to duplicate a set. We had to duplicate a real inside of a building with the windows, and so we had to back that off about 14 feet off from the real wall.
Yeah,
and then rebuild that wall on that mark and take the windows out of the of the real one. Wow. So that we could, and then put them in the fake one so that you can when you shoot through it, you can see
the outside.
The outside. So yeah. It's all the same perspective as some of the earlier shots. I mean, it was so bright. Some of the exposures are so bright, though. We didn't have to go that crazy because you can't really even see that much on the outside.
And you have, but that's the breakaway glass.
It's real glass. And what we did was it's tempered glass.
Okay.
So we have.
Like in a windshield.
Like in a windshield. And what you had to especially order these large panes of glass and use on them, which are called glass breakers. Now they're a little metal cylinder with like a nail that shoots out. It's got a little charge, a little squib inside of it. Mm-hmm. When you hit the power through it, it just taps the glass in the right spot with the right amount of pressure and it all shatters and all comes down.
So the way you usually do it is you hit it just before the actor.
Just as the actor is just about to hit it, so he goes through that glass.
So I've seen some movies where they hit it too early.
Well, he hit it too early.
Oh, really?
He hit it too early, and he bounced off of it.
Wow.
And he went back, and then I got it on the second. As he goes back, I hit it, and he goes flying out. So within the editing, it looks pretty good.
Yeah,
but it was like, whoa. And it was low budget. It cost every time that stunt guy went out the window, it cost, you know, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
Yeah.
So it worked out pretty good. But we, like I said, we did a lot of interesting things in the film. And for $1.4 million, I mean, you know, it's crazy. I mean,
that's out on DVD from what, Miramax?
Miramax put it out on DVD. Yeah. It's get it on Netflix.
Got some great extras, too, with Chris.
Chris.
I really got to know Chris Nagus.
Our eccentric producer.
I've met him several times, but he's so reserved. And I really felt like I knew him after watching
that. Well, we're going to have, hopefully, Chris and John Coca and Bob Manganiello come on the show.
One of these days, we'll have to buy a third microphone. That's all.
I'm going to buy one. I think so. I'm getting the itch.
Now that you got jobs coming in.
Now that I have some more work coming in, I can splurge on another microphone.
Great. Some of your credits are for visual effects and some are for special effects. If I got that backwards?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times visual effects and special effects, you know, are one and the same. A lot of times they're not. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really kind of a strange thing. Yes, because I got visual effects crew credits. I got special effects crew credits. And a lot of those I was doing very similar things.
Yeah.
I forget which is which. Like on Dr. Mordred, I built miniatures.
Yeah.
And
that's a credit
stop
in
motion,
itself, a miniature,
right? And I did stop motion puppets. I helped fabricate, actually refabricate, because we actually used the puppets from Subspecies and for some of that stuff. And then I also rigged up some makeup from some simple makeup effect stuff, where there's a scene that this guy gets gored by a mastodon skeleton. So I rigged up the effect where it goes into his stomach and. Gets lifted up and the blood comes out. So I did that. So I think that got all lumped together. So I'm not sure even what I got. I don't remember what I got credit on that one with.
But when I was helping you set up your listings on IMDb, we wanted to be specific and correct.
Yeah, as much as we could. Yeah.
Because you're saying it should be.
Yeah, they want to see if you're legitimate and see if you've actually done what you said you've done. I mean, there's been more than one instance where people have said that they've worked on projects and films and they never did. They've have stuff on the reel which they never had anything to do with, or they'll put visual effects stuff on the reel that they were a production assistant on.
Yeah.
You know, so that happens. And I never did that.
I had to, later on.
I mean, I've worked on a lot. I mean, I tell people I worked on about, you know, over, you know, a couple of dozen features. I've actually worked on more than that if you count just stuff that I've just PA'd.
You were
stuff
on the
like
set that day.
I was on the set that day. I was parking PA on a couple of films. I'm not going to put that down on my credits or my reel. It was a parking PA.
No, I mean, you don't want to take credit for everything.
Some things don't
look that impressive. But well, I think you did some like blood makeup on like one or two days on a local production.
Oh, yeah.
You got more credit than you expected to, didn't you? Or
Sometimes you wonder if you ever do get a credit. That was, what was the name of the film?
Cherry Crush.
Cherry Crush, that's right.
Maybe you got special thanks. I can't remember.
No, I got a credit. I got a credit. I got a special thanks and a regular credit on that, too, which was nice.
I got special thanks on Matt Eller's movie, which, you know, he was on our podcast.
Oh, Smoking Laws.
Yeah, and I guess I got...
Well, there's a film...
I didn't really help him out at all during the production, but I've been helping him since.
There's a film that I got an interesting credit. I got credited as a second unit director, when really what I did was I was a director of photography for about a third of the movie.
Okay, so there was another director.
No, there was, well, there was one Tim director. Brown. Tim Brown okay. was the director of photography on the film. Right. I came in and did about a third of it because he was unavailable.
Yeah.
And so they credited me a second unit. I also did a lot of the time-lapse yeah. stuff too. So, I mean, in the sense of that, I guess, you know.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going out and shooting time-lapse stuff without the director there.
Well, he was there and, you know, oh, it's, really? Yeah, yeah. So, I mean.
It's kind of pushing.
It was kind of semantics, you know. It was so, which is fine. I don't really care. I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, it's actually a bigger credit in some ways, you know, which is fine. And the movie Freaked,
yeah.
that Alex Winter film, that real crazy one with, who was in that movie?
Well, Alex Winter.
Besides Alex Winter. He was the writer.
Randy Quaid.
Yeah, Randy Quaid. I did a lot of work on that film. It was only on for about 5 seconds.
Yeah.
But I worked on that one for like a month and a half, wow. maybe a month or so, something like that. Well, I did there's a stop motion sequence where all these businessmen get turned into this shoe.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I mentioned that on an earlier podcast. Yeah.
Last time, you're repeating yourself. No,
yeah. Okay. So, but the point is, I never got a credit for it.
Yeah. And that's,
screen credit.
And it kind of hurts a little bit, I would think, because you did so much.
Yeah. And some of the PAs that were got credit and mm-hmm. I didn't. And a lot of times what happens is when personalities clash,
yeah.
you know, that'll affect that. And
what it seems that happened like on that every project. Production is different, and sometimes people have to fight for their credits because there's bad blood, and sometimes people just get overlooked.
Well,
and sometimes,
you assume you're going to get your credit. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's not like I didn't even know I didn't get a credit. I was working on another movie,
and
the film was on HBO, and I'm watching it, and I said, "Hey guys, come over here. I worked on this film, and I'm watching the credits, and they're going by, and then all of a sudden, you know, all the stuff where I'm supposed to be is passes by, and I'm not there. So I didn't even know until then.
Back in the day, I don't know if it goes, I guess, back to the studio system back in the 60s and before that, there'd be people who were just there at the studio working 9-to-5 job on movies, one movie after another, and they wouldn't get credit on the movie.
They wouldn't. They would.
It's not even that they were below the line.
For instance, I mean, a lot of the films. What's his name? Abbott. But he was responsible for a lot of visual effects. Mm-hmm. But he had a lot of people working for him. Most of the time, you just saw his name up there.
Okay.
I mean, that's what they did. The people that got credit were just the department heads.
Yeah.
And even not all of them got credit.
You know, I watch a lot of Warner Brothers cartoons where there's more than one person than Mel Blanc. In a cartoon, maybe? And I'm like, hey, you know, Arthur Q. Bryant didn't get credit or June Foray didn't get credit in that one. Why not? And, you know, sometimes sometimes I don't. Well, one credit I should mention that I have that a few people have pointed out to me, it's, you know, they rent the movie and they say, well, I saw your name in the credits, which is the extended edition of Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Which is one of those things that's like almost embarrassing because I paid $25 to be in the fan club and get the magazine. So they put like hundreds of people's names in the credits at the end of the
Oh, my God.
Edition. They got like 10 more minutes of credits there. They had to hire the composer to do more music because of all the names that they agreed to put.
Well, when I was working on movies back, I started back in the 80s, and there was a group of people, we've talked about them a couple times, that were from Rochester that left Rochester, went to L.A. long before I did. So I would always look for their names on the credits. Mm-hmm. But there were only like 10 people.
Right.
You know, that you know, and the effects stuff that I would have to look through. Now, it's like I can't even, I mean, it's like Korean hundreds, and, hundreds of people.
See like 3 or 4 different effects houses. There would
be 5, 6, maybe 7 of us mm-hmm. creating all the visual effects for these movies for Full Moon.
Right, because it was so.
And we all worked on stuff to get self-contained. It was actually a physical set that we were building and shooting and blah, 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 blah. The computer stuff is unbelievable how many people they have to takes to do all that.
They want to be locked into a date. We got to get it done by this date, and we got to get it done faster than is possible for one effects house to do. So as things get closer to the date, they push it off to
Ray Harryhausen and Willis O'Brien.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it was just them, and it was like Ray Harryhausen and maybe a couple of assistants.
Right.
If that.
Well, because he's acting out the character, and if he's got other people taking away some of that work, then it's not going to be him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But he was such a
which makes a difference. People would go to see a Ray Harryhausen movie,
right?
Nobody goes to see Lu Chai Chung, the 100th credited Korean name on their movie.
Oh, you're talking about current movies? No one goes
current movies. Yeah.
Well, there's effects guys that I do, you know, Pixar, I guess, is the one that people, you know, those are the animators.
No, but I'm talking about a specific name.
Yeah.
You know, people would go see a Willis O'Brien film.
Right.
He didn't direct the movie. I mean, he did King Kong. And they would go see a Ray Harryhausen film.
Right.
I didn't even know who directed half the movies Ray Harryhausen did.
And the acting certainly wasn't a draw.
Oh, come on. Patrick Wayne? Come on. Come on. Now, he was a Sinbad.
No, no. What about John Philip Law?
John Philip Law, yeah.
And that's it for another episode of Mad Dog Movies. Check us out online at maddogmovies.com/podcast, or you can write to us via email at feedback@maddogmovies.com.
We have names for people like this. We're called squids. Because we were really into special effects, and we knew all the animators and all the effects people and what they did.
Squids.
And squids. And how many animation models are in the movie? And was it shot on ones or was it shot on twos? Yeah, we find every detail like about
the Trekkies of that.
That's exactly what we were, yeah.
Music for this episode was provided by Keith Handy.